This is Gordon Stock, interviewed by Chris Alden Lee on the 13th of September 2013. Gordon Stock, Part 1.
My name is Gordon Stock. Date of birth is the 23rd of August 1926. I was born in a village called Finchingfield in Essex.
And how old are you now?
I'm 87 now.
You've just had a birthday, I was thinking.
I've had a birthday in August, yes, yeah. So I'm just over 87.
Would you say your father was an educated man?
Not all that educated, no.
Tell me about him.
He worked with his father, who had a farm in Finchingfield called Stock's Farm. And we left Finchingfield in 1933, and he started a building firm, and he was a builder in Frinton-on-Sea in Essex until he died in about, I can't remember the date, but he died in about 1966, 1965. My mother also, she was the daughter of Mr. Sullins, who owned the village stores in Finchingfield. He ran a butcher's shop in Finchingfield, a taxi firm, and he was the only petrol pump in the village, which you had to use by pumping with your hand backwards and forwards for a gallon, switch it over, drained into the car, filled it up again, and another. It took a long, long time to fill your car up. But that was my mother's side. And she died with me in my own house when I was in St. Albans. She died in about 1982, 83. I can't remember the dates. Mm. I should do, but I can't.
How was your education? Was it the local primary school?
My education wasn't much good. My father always used to tell his friends, I'm not going to have any trouble with my son's education because he'll probably be in Borstal.
Were you a terror?
Probably. No, I was one of the boys, I think. We used to play on the cliffs at Frinton, and they were subject to subsidence, and quite often we'd get into trouble getting covered in mud.
So you were an outdoor boy, were you?
I was, yes, very much so, yes.
Tomboy?
Yes. I wasn't a tomboy, no, but I was an outdoor boy, yes.
So what was your secondary school?
My secondary school was in Gloucestershire because I was evacuated to Gloucestershire during the war. Mm-hmm. And we only had, I think, either 2 or 3 days a week. We shared schooling with the local boys because there weren't enough teachers or schools to go around to take all the children. And that was Merton College in Stonehouse in Gloucestershire, or King's Langley, actually, but I lived in Stonehouse.
And university or college?
No, I didn't, no, never went there, no. Mm. I did some work after various educational. I did a Pittman's course for shorthand and typing. I've done several meteorological courses with Air Ministry. And that's about all. I've done quite a bit after school age.
Did you have a career in mind at the end of your schooling?
Yes, I always wanted to be an accountant. And that was what I wanted to be. And when I volunteered for the Navy, I volunteered as a writer. But within 2 or 3 weeks of joining the Navy as a writer, they regraded me as a telegraphist because all the writers were taken over by the Wrens. So they didn't have men pushing pens, they got the girls to do it. So that was, I was then trained as a telegraphist in Scotland at the Marconi School in Scotland, Dundee.
Had you shown any aptitude for that kind of work previously?
No, I hadn't. Well, I was in the Boy Scouts, obviously, as most boys were in those days. And we did semaphore and signalling, that sort of thing, and I quite enjoyed that, so it may have been that. But it wasn't my choice. I was told you were going to be a telegraphist, and that was that.
Mm. There was a war on, wasn't there?
Yes, yeah. That was during the war, yes.
So you joined in 43, is that right? The Royal Navy?
Yes, I joined in 43, yes.
Conscripted or...?
No, I volunteered. I volunteered because my brother-in-law was killed in a raid on Heligoland. I said to my sister, I'll vow to you I shall revenge his death. And that was why I volunteered for the Navy, to try just to do my part.
What did you mean when you said that?
What did I mean?
Mm. Did you mean to find a job?
Well, I meant I was very, very fond of him, my sister's husband. Very, very fond. And I was very upset when we heard that he'd been killed. And I vowed then that I would try and avenge his death.
By fighting?
By fighting. Yeah. By joining the services, yeah.
What led you to the Royal Navy?
My father was upset. In fact, he came to... I was sent to the naval training base at Ganges in Ipswich. And he came over there after I'd volunteered to try and get me released. But they said, no, no, he signed the papers and he's old enough. I'm afraid he's in the Navy. But my father was most upset that I did join the Navy.
Why?
I don't know why.
Yeah.
Maybe he didn't want to lose another son.
Well, quite. So why did he choose that branch of the forces rather than anything else?
Oh, I was always very keen on the Navy.
Can you remember why?
I cannot remember why, no, no.
I
think naval history was more important to me than any other history.
Trafalgar and...
Yes, so all that, yes.
Mm. Spanish Armada.
That's right, all that, yes, yes. Which we're still trying to fight. We're going to have another one in Gibraltar soon.
Well, it looks like it looks that way, doesn't it? Did you enjoy the Navy?
Yes, I think I did, yes. I enjoyed my training. I didn't have many ships. I served only on about two or three different ships. In fact, it was a good thing I didn't have a ship because if I had a ship, I wouldn't have gone to the Antarctic. Because how I got onto the expedition, I was in the Commodore's office in Chatham waiting to be posted to a ship. And I was working in the Commodore's office. And once I went in with some mail, he said, Stock... Have you heard about Scott? I said, yes, sir, he went across the pole in the Antarctic. He said, would you like to do that? I said, oh, yeah, I'd love it, sir. He said, right, well, go and see the chief bursar, get a railway ticket, go up to Admiralty, go and see Commander Bingham, and be on your best behaviour. So off I went, and that's how I joined. I got selected from Bingham. There were lots of other applicants, but I was lucky.
Let's just backtrack slightly.
Yes.
When do you think you first knew the place called the Antarctic existed? Had you read about Scott?
Oh, yes. Yes, I had. And Amundsen. And I was very, very interested in... geography's always been quite strong with me. I've always been interested in geography, and I was quite impressed with... And I could never make out why it took donkeys instead of ponies. I mean ponies instead of...
Dogs.
Dogs.
Yeah.
But that's history as well.
Yeah. So when the CO said, would you like to go to the Antarctic, why did you say yes?
Well, that was... Well, that's not an opportunity that many people would be offered. I was thrilled, really thrilled. And when I got the letter to say I'd been accepted and I was going to be going on such and such a date, I was more than excited. I was terribly thrilled.
So tell me a bit about the interview then with Bingham. What, do you remember anything about that day?
No, I think that there were various people around the table, like psychologists and probably a few educationalists.
Were you being psyched out?
Yes, we were, definitely, yes. Oh, yes.
How was that done?
Well, I think mainly by asking questions about what you did and where you'd, what you'd done previously and what you'd hope to do in the future and why, as you just said, why did you want to go down there? You had to give a reason for that.
And the reason was the adventure?
The reason was that it was a thrilling adventure, yes. Mm. Chance in a lifetime.
Why do you think the CO recommended Stock for this opportunity?
Well, he'd had a letter from Admiralty asking him to select people for interview. I think it went to all the naval depots, Portsmouth and Chatham, Greenock, went to all the commanders asking for volunteers. And they had hundreds, as you can imagine. Mm. So I was very, very lucky.
But he mentioned it to you as if perhaps he thought you'd be a, make a good...
He probably thought I'd never heard of him. No, I was very lucky.
Yeah. Tell me about then what happened after the interview. You got a letter, presumably, saying...
Yes, I got a letter to say that that I'd been selected.
And your father had been reluctant to let you join the Royal Navy.
Oh, so. He was thrilled about that.
Oh, was he?
Yes, he was. Very was pleased, that? Yes. He went round telling everybody. Yes, he was very pleased. But I got the letter, and then the letter said to report to the Admiralty on such and such a date. Passports were issued. We had to sign the Secret Service Act, because in those days we didn't want anyone to know we were going down there.
Well, your dad had taken care of that, hadn't he?
Sorry?
Your dad had told everybody, hadn't he?
Well, yes, I think he had, but he didn't know what I was going to be doing.
Oh, I see.
I forget what I was going to say now.
You had to sign the official secrecy.
Yes, we signed that. And then I turned up in the Admiralty. We were taken out to Northolt, and we were flown in an old Dakota down to Newquay. That evening we left Newquay for Lisbon, which we thought was absolutely marvellous. There was a terrific thunderstorm as we were landing, but to see all the lights after the darkness of England, to see all the lights was absolutely marvellous. Anyway, we stayed there for two or three days in a place called Estoril, just outside Lisbon, and then we joined a merchant ship, one of the Blue Funnel liners.
Oh, right.
Blue Funnel, it was...
Don't worry, Gordon.
I can't remember the name of it. Anyway, we went from Lisbon to Pernambuco, which is now Recife. And from Recife, we went down to Rio de Janeiro, where we met up with the boys from Canada with the dogs and transferred to Trapassi. And from Trapassi, we went down to Montevideo, stayed there a few days, and from Montevideo down to the Falkland Islands. On the way, we had one mishap. They were storing bedding and mattresses and various things in the funnel circuit, and they all caught fire, so we had a fire on the ship, which was quite terrible at the time. But anyway, we managed to put it out. But something went wrong with the engines, and we had the, I think it was HMS Sparrow. She took us in tow to the Falklands and was repaired down there. And this was just before Christmas in 1945. And I was lucky I spent Christmas in the Falkland Islands, but some of the lads were sent off to the Antarctic straight away. But I was kept back with others, and we went down after Christmas. So we had a nice Christmas in the Falkland Islands. And eventually we went down, and I went down first of all to Port LaCroix, base A. And I liked Port LaCroix. Very small island we were on, not much bigger than a football pitch. But the house was probably one of the most comfortable of all the bases we stayed in, I stayed in anyway. And in those days, of course, I was still a telegraphist. So I was able to speak to other people by Morse code. We didn't have any telephonic communication in those days. But so I was lucky I could talk to people outside, but unfortunately the other three lads couldn't, so I had to tell them all the time what was going on.
Again, let me take you back a little bit.
Yes.
How did your mother feel about you, our Gordon, going off so far?
Well, I think she was a little bit nervous about it all. But my father had always said to me, what you want to do, lad, is see the world at someone else's expense. I shall never forget him saying that. And my mother, I think she just thought, well, if that's what he wants to do, let him do it, yes.
She wasn't concerned about the dangers?
No, because they didn't realise what it was. I didn't realise what it was.
Okay.
It wasn't until we got going and we really knew what we were going to be doing. I had no idea that I'd be living in a small hut with three other people for a year. I had no idea at all.
So you weren't very well briefed?
We weren't, no.
Were you trained at all?
No. Oh, no. No training.
No crevasse rescue training?
No, nothing like that.
No skiing?
No. We learnt the hard way with skiing, buckling our knees and ankles.
And the journey south on the boat, that was the first time... Was that the first time you'd been on... No, you've been in the Navy, so you've been
on
ships before.
I had, yes.
But how did that compare to life on a Royal Navy ship?
Well, we were very lucky. I think this ship was called the Empire Might. I can't remember. Anyway, whatever it was, I was very lucky because in those days, cargo ships were allowed to take up to 12 passengers. If they had more than that, they had to take a doctor on board as well. So we had the accommodation of what was fare-paying passengers on this transporter. But a funny little thing happened. When we were in Lisbon, before we set sail, although I'd been in the Navy, you won't believe this, but they were taking out huge pieces of granite for building the new city in Santos, just outside Rio. And I'd gone to bed in my bunk in the cabin, and the ship was rolling from side to side. Every now and again it was rolling over and rolling back, and I became very ill. I got to get some fresh air, and I dashed outside thinking that the sea was quite rough, and we were still in the harbour, and they were loading these lumps of granite, and as the crane went over the side and lifted it over, so the ship was swaying from side to side with these large lumps of granite on. I didn't live that down, I'm afraid.
Tell me more about this fire on the Trapassi in the funnel. What do you remember?
Well, I remember people shouting. Of course, quite a small ship, so you could hear easily. But everyone shouting, and there was lots of smoke. But it wasn't a serious fire. The heat from the funnel itself, and all the mattresses and bedding were round it, and other tarpaulins, and they kept us because the funnel was quite big, but the actual hot pipe was only very small. So that they'd begun to smoulder. They were smoking, but there was no flame. It was just a smouldering thing. But it was quite frightening.
Tell me more. Why was it frightening?
Well, I thought the ship was going to go down. There's always that danger.
Yeah. And was it all hands to tackle the blaze?
Oh, yes. But we had a Norwegian crew, and they were excellent. Really excellent.
Did the FIDs help?
Oh, yes. Well, we threw everything overboard, of course.
But I was going to ask you that, yes. So all the mattresses went?
Everything went overboard, yeah.
So did that have repercussions later when you were trying to bed down?
I don't think so. I can't... I mean, we weren't interested in the logistics, but I don't think it did. They obviously got replacements from somewhere.
Tell me about Port Stanley in 1945.
Yes.
What was it like?
I like Port Stanley. quite a cute little place, really. And, of course, we were very lucky. We had accommodation in the Colonial Secretary's house because he wasn't there at the time. And we had to cook for ourselves. So we got used to each other, got to know each other. And the Falkland Islands has made us more than welcome. And, of course, we went out, as I say, Jeff Hattersmith was quite a keen horseman, so we did quite a bit of going out on the horseback.
Who else was in your team?
Mike, his father was a doctor in Selsey Bill. And I went down there and stayed with them when we came back sometime. Michael Harvey. There was he and I and two Falkland Islanders. Frank was the cook and a chap called Peck was the sort of handyman. He did all the bases had a Falkland Islander handy. They called them handyman, but they did all, they were quite often good carpenters or so.
You're talking now about the team that went to Port Lockroy.
Yes.
Yeah. So there were four of you.
Just four of us. Yeah.
Did you so you had Christmas on Stanley?
Yes.
Were there celebrations?
Oh yes. And what they do there is they don't have turkeys, but they kill a cow in calf and they have the unborn calf as their festive meal. And it was very delicious. I suppose it's veal, is it, really?
Yeah, I think so,
but
yeah.
They made a fuss of all this. It's quite good.
Was there a ceremony of some kind?
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah.
What do you recall?
Yeah. I recall one incident on the island. I can't remember whether it was the first time I was there or the second. I think it was probably the first time. Dr. Sladen.
Bill Sladen.
Bill Sladen was the... No, Dr. Sladen, not our Bill Sladen. He was another Dr. Sladen. He was the doctor on the island.
Slessor?
No, Slessor was part of the expedition. But this Dr. Sladen was a resident doctor in the Falklands. It so happened that he took up a practice in Frinton-on-Sea after he left the Falklands. So that was strange. Anyway, he invited us all round to dinner one evening and he said, "Stock, do you like prunes?" I said, "Oh, yes, I like prunes." So he gave me prunes and custard. During the evening, I felt violently ill and they sent for him. "Stocky's very ill. He's running a high temperature and he's terrible." Well, he had a motorbike and a sidecar, which was like that table. It wasn't a normal sidecar. It was just a flat thing. That was his ambulance. So he put me on here and stretched me off, took me to hospital and pumped my stomach out. But do you know what the rascal had done? He'd soaked the prunes in gin. So it really upset me. He nearly killed me, I think.
And the ambulance was a motorbike with a stretcher.
Yes, that was amazing. Yeah, you see this, because I think there were maybe two or three cars. The governor had a car. The chap that ran the grocery store, he had a car. But I think there were probably only two or three cars. So Doc Slessor didn't. And there was no ambulance, of course. Well, there may have been. I don't know. But anyway, he took me off. He used this sidecar as a stretcher. It was purposely built.
Mm.
Had straps and everything on it. But I should never forget that.
So you ended up in the hospital, I guess.
Sorry?
You ended up in the hospital there.
Oh, just for overnight, yes, yeah. I think. Just a precaution. But I was ill, very ill.
Were there any races around Christmas? Horse races?
Yes, there were, yes. Oh, yes, they had horse races on the course, yes. And we all went to that, of course.
Any FIDs take part?
I think they did, yes. Yeah, they did, yeah.
Hattersley Smith?
Oh, I think he probably did. He would have done, yes. But of course they don't have saddles. They just put a sheepskin over the horse's back and sit on the sheepskin. They can't make out how we had stirrups and reins. Entirely different way of riding a horse out there to what it is back here, back in England.
Mm. And everybody would go to watch, I guess.
Oh, yes. And then, of course, later on, the second year, the race course, we turned that into a landing strip for the Oster, which then became an ambulance airplane, air ambulance.
Right. Okay.
And I was the first passenger in that plane because I helped Vic Spencer, he was the pilot. I helped him put the Oster together because obviously it went out as a kit. And we put it together. We weren't quite sure whether we'd connected all the wires up right or not. So he said, "You're coming with me." So the first flight we took, well, I say flight, we didn't. We just ran up and down the runway to make sure everything was in order. Then came the big takeoff and off we went. That was quite exciting.
And that was built in the Falklands?
Yes. Well, we assembled it in the Falklands. It was in a crate, in a kit form,
yeah.
Like flat pack.
Yeah. Had you any previous experience of
it? Oh, no. I think the first time I flew was at Clacton-on-Sea at an air rally when they, you know, you paid £5 and went up for 10 minutes.
But you had no experience of building that kind
of
thing?
Oh, no. Mind you, we had all the instructions supplied by, I don't know, is it de Havilland that make Osters? I can't remember, but the instructions are fairly well there, you know, put this wire there and make this and screw this and do that. And it was quite easy to do it, except the wires had to go all the way down the fuselage to the tail, and that sometimes was a bit tricky getting it to the end of the end of the plane.
So it must have been a bit of a heart-stopping moment when you tried to fly this thing.
That's right.
That you'd just built.
Yeah. Well, Vic was an experienced pilot. In fact, he stayed out there for 2 or 3 years, I think.
Mm. Anyway, the time came for you to head further south.
Yes.
So how did you? What did you sail to Port Lockroy?
I went down on the Trepassey.
That continued its journey, did it?
Yeah.
Yeah. And you were wintered at Lockroy in 1946.
Yes.
So were you? The hut was already open, wasn't it?
Yes.
Were you still part of Operation Tabarin then?
No, we started off as Operation Tabarin, but during our first stay in the Falklands, we were redesignated to FIDS, and the Foreign Office handed it over to the Colonial Office.
Right.
The Foreign Office ran it as Operation Tabarin, I think, right. And then the Colonial Office took it over as FIDS.
But you were still a naval rating, I guess, were you?
No. I got a special release from the Navy.
Temporary or permanent?
Temporary.
Right.
Because I had to go to HMS Discovery on the Thames to get my release when I came back. But it didn't make any difference to my pension. It didn't count the time I was in the Antarctic. I'm always annoyed about that.
So you were transferred from the Navy to FIDS, effectively.
Yes. Yeah.
And the FIDS are paying your salary.
Yes.
At their rate.
That's right.
Rather than the higher...
Rather than Navy rates, yes.
Navy rate. Yeah. Although, of course, in the Antarctic you had nothing to spend your money on, I guess.
No. Although they did charge us for sending telegrams, I think.
Okay. Tell me about what met your eyes when you sailed towards Port Lockroy.
Well, the enormity of the ice itself... The mountains were absolutely magnificent. Mind you, going down the sea was pretty rough. As I say, although I was in the Navy, I wasn't a good sailor. And it was very, very rough across the Drake Passage. But the first sighting of the Antarctic ice itself and the icebergs was just something that you had to see, you can't imagine it. The scenery is absolutely fantastic. And the sky at night, some of the colours in the sky were just magnificent, lovely.
The stars.
And the stars and the moon. I mean, when I was at Deception Island, you could, full moon, you could actually read the newspaper without glasses. The moon was that bright. Not the small print, but you could read the headlines. And the moon, you could, in your naked eye, you could see the mountains on the moon with binoculars or a telescope. Fantastic.
The atmosphere, the Earth's atmosphere was a lot cleaner.
Yes.
Then than now. So
yeah.
Was that because it was cleaner in those days, or was it because you were in the Antarctic that you got what was the clarity down to? Why was it so clear?
No, I don't go along with this warming, climate change. I think it's a cycle every 11 years with the Earth's movement in conjunction with the sun and the moon. The climate obviously changes and it comes in cycles, and people, I think, forget that 11 years ago this was just as bad as it is this year, or just as hot this year as it was 11 years ago. Not exactly 11 years, but the cycle's about that, so I believe anyway.
But I was thinking about the clarity of the air, because that struck me about the Antarctic, was the clarity of the air.
That's right.
Particularly...
Well, there's no pollution, is there, really? And, of course, there's not many wind directions taking polluted air from the equator to the southern regions. It's more or less the winds are going towards and round the equator. They don't flow towards the poles, they flow away from the poles, because the colder air is always going to move to the warmer. So there's never really any polluted air going towards the Antarctic.
So that impressed you straight away?
Oh, the yes. Beauty of the place. Very impressed, yes.
What about the accommodation?
Well, the accommodation was okay, because, of course, as you just said, it was occupied before we went there, so I think we had to get into other people's beds. I can't recollect that we took our own fresh bedding. But the big things about it, of course, was there was no heating. Well, we had a coal-burning stove in the middle of the hut. No electric light, no sanitation. This is what people can't understand, how you could live a whole year with no running water, no electricity. You couldn't have a bath. Well, you could. If you like to spend all day melting snow down to make enough water for a bath, you were lucky. So we had a bath about once every 2 months, I think. And the first year I was there, of course, at Port LaCroix, we had a cook from the Falkland Islands, Frank. Can't remember his surname, Frank. And he was a very good cook, but he did nothing but cook. So we didn't cook for ourselves. But after that, Bingham decided, no, we're not having this. Everyone's going to take a share of the cooking. So we did a month cook duty, and then the other chaps had, and then you did another month. So that was okay, because I learned to cook, so I'm a very good cook now.
Again, you learned on the job.
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah. Oh, yes, I had no idea. I think I could boil an egg. That was about as much as I could do.
Were there some early disasters then on the table?
Quite possibly, especially trying to make bread.
Hmm.
Making bread was very, very difficult. Sometimes it came out like rock, and other times it came out like glue. But I was never very successful at bread making.
Is that largely because of the unreliability of the oven?
And the temperature, of course, yes. We didn't get the yeast to rise up right, because you couldn't get the yeast to rise because it was too cold. And if you put it in the oven to try and warm it up, then it got too hot and turned into a gooey mess.
So was anybody able to make bread properly?
Oh, yes. So Frank could make bread, yeah.
Hmm.
And Dick Bird was good at... unfortunately, he was killed down there, but... Dick Bird was a good bread maker.
Mm. What happened to him?
He was burnt in the fire at Hope Bay. And I recall telling a story of the fire at Hope Bay. Sorry, this is going to go on a little further, but...
That's all right, that's fine.
We didn't know what had happened at Hope Bay, except that they'd gone off the air and there was no communication from them. And I had a dream that there'd been a fire and that the base was on fire and Dick managed to get outside and he realised someone was missing. And he went back into the fire and unfortunately perished. And his body, I dreamt, was under a bunk, because we had bunks with one chap underneath and one on top. Dick's body was found under the bottom bunk, under the bottom bunk. He'd obviously been crawling around and lost his way out. And when we, because I was on the ship that went in first, that saw the fire, and when we went, we discovered where his body was.
Have you had other similar experiences?
Sometimes I do. I still do. I still get things like that, yes.
And that you had complete conviction that this dream had a...
No, I wake up sometimes, even now, I wake up sometimes convinced that what I've dreamt is actually true.
And generally it is?
Generally it is, yes.
So in the case of Dick Bird, you went knowing where he would be?
Well, not convinced, no.
Okay.
But it was a...
It was the first place.
It was a revelation when we did find him. Yeah. But we had to be very careful. I must admit that I was not the first person into the hut because Salter, he came, he was the only survivor. And he came down to the beach when we, well, at least the shore, when we went ashore, to warn us that there'd been a tragedy. And he was the only survivor. And, of course, other people went to the hut. I was not the first one. I wasn't in the hut.
Well, this had been, in fact, Bill Sladen?
No, this is Salter.
Salter.
Willoughby Salter.
OK.
I don't know what happened to Willoughby. He lived up in Yorkshire somewhere, I think.
So you...
But Willoughby was the meteorologist at Hope Bay, so he and I were of the same ilk.
Right, so he got there before... He wasn't based at...
He was already spent the year there, yes.
Right, so he was based at Hope Bay.
He was at Hope Bay, yes.
And he survived the fire.
And he survived the fire, and he was the only one. And his story would be worth telling because he lived alone on scraps... I can't remember how many months before we got in there, but this was the difficulty with the expeditions, of course. If anything happened, seriously happened, there was nothing could be done for you until the ice allowed the ships into the bases. And this happened at Hope Bay, and it happened at Deception Island, and it happened at Admiralty Island. So... Three of the bases were left with serious injuries or deaths without anybody knowing until we arrived.
Mm. So how did you get from Port Lockroy to Hope Bay? That was in a ship of some sort?
Oh, yes. I think on that occasion I went on the Scoresby, I can't remember, but I think it was the Scoresby. I hated the Scoresby. Very uncomfortable.
And the decision to go was simply because you hadn't heard from them?
Oh, no, we went to relieve. We had a relief crew. We had a relief party.
I see.
It was to relieve the party that had been there all the year, and the new party were on the ship ready to go, and all the stores and everything was ready to replace the base with a new party. Otherwise, nobody knew of the accident at all, the fatality there.
Right, so the dream you had could not have been based on news that there had been a fire.
No.
It was purely some sort of psychological...
Coincidental. And, yes,
purely. Or psychic connection.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm. I'm not psychic, I don't think, but that would appear to be...
In that incident.
Yes.
So, talk me through arriving at Hope Bay. What do you remember of the arrival there? And...
Well, I was absolutely amazed because, as you probably know, the Antarctic suffers a lot from very, very thick fog. And we'd been sailing through this thick fog for quite a few hours. And suddenly I heard the anchors drop. And we couldn't see a thing, not a thing. And we slept. And when I woke up next morning, we were in the middle of this Hope Bay. How the captain got it there, I should never know. Magnificent. I can't remember his name either, the captain of the Trapezi, Scoresby. No, it must have been the Trapezi. Yeah, it was the Trapezi. It wasn't the Scoresby.
Okay. And could you see the wrecked hut from the ship?
Not to my knowledge, no, because I think it was... The hut at... the base hut at Hope Bay was some way off the shore.
So there's a party was put together.
And of course I didn't know where to look anyway because I'd never been there before.
So was there a sort of landing party put together?
Oh, yes.
Did you volunteer?
Well, no, I didn't. I don't think they asked for volunteers. It was just natural for the people that were going to be relieving the others for them to go first.
Of course, yes.
I mean, I probably stayed on board ship helping to unload the cargo.
So what was the first news you got that confirmed your dream?
Well, when they came back and said, you know, where they'd what they'd seen and where they found the bodies.
Mm. And did you go and see for yourself?
I did go up there and see, yeah, but the bodies had been removed by then. I didn't actually see Dick's body.
What did you see?
Well, that hut was completely, there was nothing left of it. It was absolutely ruined. We were more concerned, of course, about Willoughby than, well, not about the others leaving, but, I mean, Willoughby wasn't in a very good state, as you can imagine. He was very emotional. Overcome when he was relieved by us because he'd spent so many months on his own. Must have been a terrible time for him. No, the only time I volunteered for something was when we went down with Bingham, we wanted to get some seals to feed to the dogs. So the first flow we came across with some seals on, Bingham said, right, we want those seals for the dogs. Now, who's a good marksman? And I didn't say anything. I said, oh, I'm not bad, sir. So he gave me a service revolver and he said, right, and you know how seagulls float over the tops of the funnels on the ships? They just float like this. He said, right, shoot that bird down. I took the revolver, hit the bird, bang, first said, right, you're in charge of the landing party, go and get those seals. And we did get them. That was the first seals we got for the dogs. But of course, after that, we killed hundreds.
Yeah.
People wouldn't like us to be telling that, but we had to kill them for A, ourselves, and B, the dogs. It was the only meat the dogs had.
So let's go back to Port Locker, I think.
Yes.
We got sidetracked to the Hope
Bay. Yeah, I did, yeah.
Fire and the tragedy of that. But tell me a bit more about the more routine life at Port Lockroy. What sort of lifestyle did you adopt?
Well, it was a routine. I mean, I had to get up. Well, I say you got up in the morning and the first message you sent, the weather report I sent to Port Stanley on the radio, and we did that every 3 hours, so that kept me going. I had to keep the engines going to provide the power. I had to do my duties to collect the snow or ice for our drinking water. Occasionally we would go off skiing somewhere. We couldn't ski much on the island itself because it was too small. But we did have an outboard motor, and we used to go across to the what we called the mainland, Graham Land, and ski on the glaciers up there. But that didn't last for too long because we were going out one day and the outboard propeller hit a little piece of ice and sheared it, and the engine went flying into the water. So we never had a boat to use after that, except when we were rowing, so we couldn't go too far away because of the currents.
What was the hut like? Was it cosy?
The hut was very comfortable. When you go there in the summer, which is quite nice, the summer's quite warm, you can go about in a shirt sleeve in the summer. People think it's going to be cold all the year, but it isn't. It's quite pleasant in the summer. But one of the things that struck me was, why have they got all these wires? All the wires were running this way and that way all over the house, the hawser wires. But in the winter, of course, we soon found out why. You'd get a gust of a wind 120 miles an hour or something, and you could hear the wind whistling through these wires.
It was cables were holding the hut down.
Yeah, they were holding the hut down.
How were they?
Because it was only just put onto the rocks. Yeah.
How were the cables anchored?
They were cemented into the... We had pins that they drove into the rock and then they were cemented in.
Did it feel secure?
Oh, yes. Sometimes we got a bit nervous that the thing was going to blow us away. And, of course, we had a wire from the hut to the observatory where the instruments were kept for temperature and pressure, etc., etc. And you hooked yourself onto this wire and led yourself out, because if you tried to walk across there without, you'd get blown away to nothing. Can't imagine how strong, not a very strong wind to blow you over, actually. To try and walk against a 50, 60 knot wind in icy conditions is quite difficult.
So you had a harness of some sort and
yourself. Just clipped ourselves onto this wire, and that was only when the weather was very bad.
Yeah. Right. So the Met instruments were in a different building, were they?
Well, they were in a little...
Stevenson screen?
A little screen, yes. Yeah.
Were there any other buildings? Was there an outhouse?
Yes, there was an old Nissen hut, you know, the round... That's where we kept all the stores. Because, of course, you can imagine 4 men living a year go through quite a bit of food. So all the food was kept in the Nissen hut. And subsequently everything got frozen. So you opened a can of tinned potatoes or something and it was just a mushy, they'd all frozen and broken up. Nothing like a potato when you opened it up.
Were they still edible?
Oh yes, they were edible, all right, yes. Yeah. But we had to ration ourselves out to, at the beginning of the month we listed, you can have 8 tins of potatoes, 6 tins of beans, 4 tins of tomatoes, 3 tins of sardines, and that was your allocation for the month's cooking. So we knew exactly what food was left and what we were using.
So the food sounds as though it might have been quite basic most of the time.
And most of it was dried. We had dried potatoes, dried beetroot, dried cabbage, dried onions, dried carrots. Everything was dried. Except, as I say, occasionally we had tinned food, but taking a lot of tinned food down south was quite difficult. And anyway, it quite often, if you had a tin of peaches or something, the juice would freeze and burst the can open, so they were no good anyway. So we had dried peaches, dried prunes, dried sultanas, dates. Everything was dried.
What were you cooking on?
We had an Essie stove. They were quite efficient. And when I went down to the Falkland Islands, the Scoresby came in to thing, and they had a cat on board. And I liked this cat, so I tucked it under my anorak and took it ashore. And they left without their cat. But this poor cat, we had nowhere to put it, so we had a little blanket, and we put him in the bottom shelf of the Essie, and he slept in there every night in the bottom shelf of the Essie to keep warm.
Did it have a name? Did the cat have a name?
I can't remember. Probably, yes.
And was it with you for a long time?
He was with me that year. I left him there, yes.
Oh, right.
Yeah. He didn't like going out in the snow very much, though. He couldn't. Had to jump from one place to another.
How do the four of you get on?
Well, I think very well. It's amazing, actually. But little things annoy you, like the way a bloke cleaned his teeth, or he blew his nose, or he ate his food. Oh, I wish he wouldn't do that. I mean, they would say the same about me, but there were little things that niggled you all the time, and occasionally you would say something, and it got to you, and you'd eventually say, oh, for goodness sake, when you do that, don't do it that way, do it this way. But, and of course, the other little friction was, as I said earlier on, that I was able to communicate with the outside world and they weren't, and they were always saying, well, why don't you get in touch with someone and have a conversation? But you couldn't. Although I got in touch with a radio station in Hilversum in
Holland.
Mm.
I've been there, actually.
Have you? Mm. I forget what it was called, but I've always wanted to meet the guy. But I used to send him a telegraphic message to say, because we used to listen, we had a radio that we could listen to, so we sent messages to this station in Hilversum, and they played, and the guy used to come on and say, and now here's the lovely Louisa or Annabelle, whatever she was, to speak to the boys in the Antarctic. And quite often they sent us messages on their radio program.
So you could hear that vocally?
Yeah, we had a Marconi CW receiver, like any other radio set, yeah.
And you could hear, it was that Hilversum was the Dutch World Service, I seem to remember. So, but you could hear it as if it was an ordinary radio programme.
Oh, yes, yes.
Could you hear the BBC?
We could hear the BBC.
Again, the World Service.
Sometimes communication was very, very difficult. We get what we call blackouts, and you hear, you could get no communication at all. Other days it was loud and clear. Some days we were all pulling our ear and you could hardly hear what they were saying. Communications were very difficult, signal-wise, because of the heaviside layer and all the different atmospheric.
Were they doing beastie work at that point? Ionospherics? Did you come across any?
I did go to Datchet to do an ionospherics course, and I took the instruments down there with me, but unfortunately we didn't have strong enough power to drive them all, so I wasn't able to take any measurements.
That was the first year, was it?
No, that was...
later on?
That would have been in Port... 49. In Deception Island.
Yeah.
It must have been, yes, Deception Island, because obviously I'd come back to go on the course in Datchet. I was very interested in that, though, because up to then I hadn't realised that there were all these various layers in the atmosphere that affected communications.
But it must have been frustrating to... I know we're leaping about in our chronology now, but it doesn't matter too much. It must have been frustrating to have gone back to Britain to do that course.
That's right.
Got back to the Antarctic and then been thwarted.
Yeah, well, I was able to tell them that we couldn't get it to operate.
Mm.
I forget what it wanted. It wanted a higher power or less power or something, a different current. We were AC and they were DC or whatever it was, but it didn't work.
Tell me more about Port Lockroy. I mean, did you get out much?
Oh, yes, we went out quite a bit. And we tried to do some fishing. not very successful. And of course, we had quite a large colony of penguins nearby. And at the time of the year when they were laying their eggs, we would go across and take a few eggs from them, take a few birds with us as well, because penguin breasts are quite tasty. Penguins' livers and hearts are quite nice on toast. So we went to visit them quite often, and also we did some different studies of the penguins and how they bred and whether they were the same mates each year and whether they went back to the same nest each year. And I remember on one occasion, because you were asked by various universities to do different studies, so we did, and they asked us to test the colour of penguins. So we painted various little, because you know they build their nests out of stones, they pile them up and sit on top of the stones. We painted the stones red, blue, yellow, green, pink, silver, and which colour the penguins picked out first. And it was the silver ones. Somebody was interested in that, but we weren't.
So again, you were just ordinary men following scientific instructions.
Yeah, and the same with rocks. I mean, we had books on geology and rock formations, and we were asked to try and find different minerals in the rocks, which occasionally we would go out and hack away at a few rocks to see if we got plenty of copper, but not a lot else.
It all sounds slightly amateurish, doesn't it?
Oh, yes.
Was it?
Well, at Port La Croix, of course, we had no... It wasn't a scientific base. The scientific bases were Hope Bay and later on Marguerite Bay. But none of the bases were really scientific. We had ornithologists, glaciologists... Hattersley Smith, he was a glaciologist. But the rest of us, of course, were just, I think, there to occupy the base.
Mm. And the meteorology was a main function.
Oh, no, yeah, meteorology, yes.
Port La Croix.
Yeah. Meteorology was the main function at all of the bases. But some of the bases would have an ornithologist, some would have a glaciologist, some would have a geologist. But at Port La Croix, our first year, we had nothing except meteorology.
Was it interesting?
And then, of course, the other thing we had to do, if the weather was really okay for it, was to send up these helium balloons to measure the winds in the upper atmospheres. Mm. And that took some doing, standing there looking through a telescope in freezing weather.
Well, describe it more fully. What do you remember, Gordon?
Well, first of all, of course, we had these huge cylinders, which I'd never used in my life before, of hydrogen, and you blew these huge balloons up filled with hydrogen, and you put this little anemometer thing on the bottom of it to record the wind speed and sent it off, and then you had to track this through a telescope, track the movement of it. You would call out the readings, and another guy would be standing alongside you writing down the different readings, because you couldn't do both. I mean, if you took your eyes off the thing, you'd lose sight of it, because you can imagine it went up quite some height, and if you took your eyes off it for a moment or two, you'd lose sight of it. So that was another thing we had to do.
So the only way in the 40s to work out how fast the balloon was moving was to plot its course on the ground? Or did it send back a signal? Did the anemometer
send... No, it didn't send back signals, no.
So how were you reading the anemometer?
We couldn't read it. We just put it on. It was on there mainly to stabilise the balloon,
right.
I think.
And would you recover it later, or would the balloon...
No. There was a little message on it that if it was found, to return it to the colonial office and you get a £5 reward or something. But I can't recall any being recovered.
So if you weren't taking a reading sent back from the anemometer, how were you calculating how fast the balloon was moving?
We weren't able to take the temperatures all we could do was take the wind speed.
But how would you work out what the wind speed was up there?
Well, we had a chart.
I see.
The guy writing it down, we had a chart so that if it moved sort of 5 degrees on the on your telescope, those 5 degrees was equivalent to 45 miles an hour, or if right. it moved only 1 degree, it was only 15 miles an hour. That was how it was done.
So you were comparing its movement to a graduated
yes.
control?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Were there ever any surprising weather patterns?
Yes. Until recently, well, 2 years ago, when we had the tsunami, I'd never connected it. But I think it was about a July or August time in Port La Croix. I don't know if you've been to Port La Croix.
I have, yes.
Well, you know the Namur Channel is quite narrow, but very deep and steep mountains. Well, we're in the hut one evening, or one afternoon, and we heard this terrific rushing sound. And the water came down the Namur Channel in a huge wave. Great lumps of ice and icebergs flowing round into the whatever channel, forget what that was called. Anyway, down this narrow channel. It filled the channel up. And then suddenly, it all drained off.
Mm.
And where we were used to seeing maybe 20 or 30 feet of water was dry. Water had completely gone back out to the Namur Channel. And all the icebergs were running along the bottom of the thing. Now, that was quite frightening. And it lasted for maybe an hour or two. And I got on the radio and said to Bingham, we've had this terrific tidal wave. Quite frightening. Oh, don't be daft, Stock, he said. Of course you haven't. I said, well, we have, and we've all witnessed it. He didn't believe it. But the following year, when I went down to the Argentine Islands, we were going to occupy the hut used by Wordy's expedition, the Panola expedition. And the hut wasn't there. And again, I got on the radio to speak to Bingham. I said, there's no sign of a hut here. Oh, don't be silly, Stock, you're in the wrong place. I said, I'm not, sir. We've seen where the Panola was anchored. We've seen the anchorage place. There's a dory here, upturned dory, and there are various other relics scattered about the island. Oh, you can't be in the right place. We are. Anyway, the hut had been demolished. And strangely enough, several metres from the water were large lumps of icebergs.
Mm.
Now, how did they get there? So what had hit us in the Port La Croix the year before had also affected the Argentine Islands probably much worse because it took the hut away completely.
Yeah.
And that was a two-storey building.
Oh, really?
But it wasn't anchored down with wires like we were, so we were lucky. Mind you, we weren't threatened because the hut at Port La Croix is quite above sea level.
So, when the tide went out again, and you said you could see the dry sea bed,
yeah,
20 feet below,
yeah,
how long was it like that?
Oh, only a matter of seconds or minutes. No,
right.
It didn't stay long. Okay. It was completely whoosh, whoosh. It was frightening, terrifying. Actually, no one believed us.
Was Bingham a bit like that? Was he a bit?
A bit sceptical about everything, because. Well, cut another story. When we had the dogs, you see, we had a dog. When we went to the Argentine Islands, we took some dogs with us with the purpose of breeding our own dogs down south for sledging teams.
Mm.
So I think we had about 12 or 15 dogs. And he insisted that we used this one dog to service the female dogs, the bitches, because it had a short legs, big chest. And that's what he wanted. He wanted dogs with big wide chests, little legs for running. And I kept saying to him, this dog's no good. He said, yes, it is. I said, no, it isn't. All the dogs are getting, all the puppies are getting rickets. We've had to kill them all. We only had about, as I say, out of probably about 10 or 15 bitches, I think we only had about three successful breeds. And he insisted that we kept this dog. I said, well, why can't we use one of the other dogs? No. Mind you, I don't like to criticise him because he was a dog expert. But
he also sounds a bit pedantic, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Was that frustrating?
He was the commander. He was in charge, so you had to do as he told you.
One of the more common things to hear from FIDs is that the frustration they felt at the lack of understanding they got from HQ. That the FIDs in the south often thought that the guys in Cambridge or London hadn't really any idea what was going on.
No, I never found that. Mind you, you see, being in communication with people was probably a little, as I said earlier on, it did make a difference. I was able every day to speak to someone, even if I was only using Morse code. I was actually speaking to someone. And the other guys, they weren't, so they got a little bit frustrated, I think, about it. I know they did, actually, because they used to say, for goodness sake, you know, why don't you tell us what's going on? And I said, well, there's not much to tell us. It would tell you what's going on. We could hear the news, as I said earlier on, but quite often, you see, they were all 12-volt batteries, which you had to charge up, and we had a bank of 12-volt batteries. And sometimes I say, well, we can't listen to the radio for too long because the batteries are running down. I've got to charge them up, and I've got to have them charged up to use the telegraphy.
To file the Met off.
There were little things like that. Why don't you put the radio on? I said, well, we put it on for half an hour or so, but because they use quite a lot of power, those sets.
Yeah.
And the other frustrating thing, of course, was only having a candle to read by.
No lantern.
We had what they called tilly lamps, but we didn't have enough spare
wicks.
Mantles,
yeah.
Because they didn't last very long. You only had to put the lamp down with a bit of a jolt and the mantle would just burst. Well, that was another thing you had to do, of course, was fill the tilly lamps up every day and service those, clean them and. Well, the normal things of life that you did each day. I mean, washing up and cooking and making your bed and doing the normal chores.
Were you interested in what was happening elsewhere in the world? Did the guys bothered about news?
Well, I think
from
they were,
north,
yeah.
The north,
yeah. Because, of course, the first few months we were down there, the Japanese war, the Far East war was still on.
Yeah.
It wasn't till July, was it? July 45 that finished. So the first part, we were very interested to know what was going on, yes, of course.
So you heard about Hiroshima, did you?
Oh, yes, yes.
Nagasaki.
Oh, we knew all that, yes. But we were always terrified that some foreign ship might come and take us over. We were very vulnerable. I mean, we had no protection for our own safety. If the Argentine ship came in as they did when we were at Deception Island and decided that they were going to kick us out, they could have done so with ease. There was no way we could have defended ourselves. So you felt fairly vulnerable sometimes that someone was going to come round the corner and take you off.
Would you say it was a happy year at Port Lockroy?
Oh, I think so, yes. Yeah. The two Falkland Islanders were very nice chaps.
There was no social divide between blighters and Falklanders?
No.
When it came to the end of that year, how was the decision made about what happened next?
Well, I suppose Bingham again decided where you were going, And he decided that I was going down to the Argentine Islands. And as I've just said, when we got there, the hut wasn't there. So we did have on board the Trapassi timber that they were going to build another hut somewhere else, and they decided that that would come off, but there wasn't enough of it, and they had to go back to Deception Island and knock down one of the old whaling base huts and bring that down and complete our thing. But for several weeks, I slept in the crate that the diesel generator came in. That was my base while we built this hut. But I'm told it's still there, Wordy House. And the little shack where I had my radio station, that's still there. But many a times I sat in there and the exhaust from the... We had these little list of petrol engines, and the exhaust would melt the snow, and then, of course, when you'd finished, they'd cool down and it all freeze over. So the next time you went in, everything was all frozen up. You'd be sitting there sending your message and all the fumes weren't going out the exhaust at all. They were all coming back inside the building. And many a time I had to escape rather quickly through the door to get some fresh air.
let's pause, Gordon.
Yes.
And I'll change the recording.
Okay.
And we'll resume.
You've switched it off, have you?